take at a spring. Now, I knew my way, but I could not resist tracing it out a little further. It was well that I did so, for I found just within the fence a sunken stream, rather full at the time, in consequence of the rains, too deep to wade and too broad to jump. It struck me that it would be easy enough to take a board from the fence and lay it over for a bridge. I measured the breadth with my eye and decided the board would span it. Then I went back as I had come and returned to find De Taille still raving. As he could understand nothing, it seemed to me rather a fool's errand to go off in search of comfort for him. But a conscious moment might come, and moreover, I began to be interested in my undertaking, and so I agreed with Magnin that I should go and take some food and rest, and return to the vigne that night. I told my landlady that I was going into the country and should return the next day, and I went to Nazari's and laid in a stock of sandwiches and filled my flask with something they called sherry, for though I was no great wine drinker, I feared the night chill. It was about 7 o'clock when I started, and I retraced my morning's steps exactly. As I reached the lane, it occurred to me that it was still too light for me to pass unobserved over the stream, and I made a place for myself under the hedge and lay down, quite screened by the thick curtain of tangled, overhanging ivy. I must have been out of training and tired by the morning's walk, for I fell asleep. When I awoke, it was night. The stars were shining, a dank mist made its way down my throat, and I felt stiff and cold. I took a pull at my flask, finding it nasty stuff, but it warmed me. Then I rang my repeater, which struck 11:15, got up and shook myself free of the leaves and brambles, and went on down the lane. When I got to the fence, I sat down and thought the thing over. What did I expect to discover? What was there to discover? Nothing. Nothing but that Marcello was alive. And that was no discovery at all, for I felt sure of it. I was a fool, and had let myself be allured by the mere stage nonsense and mystery of the business, and a mouse would creep out of this mountain of precautions. Well, at least I could turn it to account by describing my own absurd behaviour in some story yet to be written, and as it was not enough for a chapter, I would add to it by further experience. "Come along," I said to myself, "you're an ass, but it may prove instructive." I raised the top board from the fence noiselessly. There was a little stile there, and the boards were easily moved. I laid down my bridge with some difficulty and stepped carefully across, and made my way to the laurel grove as quickly and noiselessly as possible. There all was thick darkness, and my eyes only grew slowly accustomed to it. After all, there was not much to see. Some stone seats in a semicircle, and some fragments of columns set upright with antique busts upon them. Then, a little to the right, a sort of arch, with apparently some steps descending into the ground, probably the entrance to some discovered branch of a catacomb. In the midst of the enclosure, not a very large one, stood a stone table, deeply fixed in the earth. No one was there, of that I felt certain, and I sat down, having now got used to the gloom, and fell to eat my sandwiches, for I was desperately hungry. Now that I had come so far, was nothing to take place to repay me for my trouble? It suddenly struck me that it was absurd to expect Marcello to come out to meet me and perform any mad antics he might be meditating there before my eyes for my especial satisfaction. Why had I supposed that something would take place in the grove, I do not know, except that this seemed a fit place for it. I would go and watch the house, and if I saw a light anywhere, I might be sure he was within. Any fool might have thought of that. But a novelist lays the scene of his drama and expects his characters to slide about in the grooves like puppets. It is only when mine surprise me that I feel they are alive. When I reached the end of the ilex alley, I saw the house before me. There were more cabbages and onions after I had left the trees, and I saw that in this open space I could easily be perceived by anyone standing on the balcony above. As I drew back again under the ilexes, a window above, not the one on the balcony, was suddenly lighted up. But the light did not remain long, and presently a gleam shone through the glass oval over the door below. I had just time to spring behind the thickest trunk near me when the door opened. I took advantage of its creaking to creep up the slanting tree like a cat and lie out upon a projecting branch. As I expected, Marcello came out. He was very pale and moved mechanically like a sleepwalker. I was shocked to see how hollow his face had become as he held a candle, still lighted, in his hand, and it cast deep shadows on his sunken cheeks and fixed eyes, which burned wildly and seemed to see nothing. His lips were quite white, and so drawn that I could see his gleaming teeth. Then the candle fell from his hand, and he came slowly and with a curiously regular step on into the darkness of the ilexes, I watching him from above. But I scarcely think he would have noticed me had I been standing in his path. When he had passed, I let myself down and followed him. I had taken off my shoes, and my tread was absolutely noiseless. Moreover, I felt sure he would not turn around. On he went with the same mechanical step until he reached the grove. There, I knelt behind an old sarcophagus at the entrance and waited. What would he do? He stood perfectly still, not looking about him, but as though the clockwork within him had suddenly stopped. I felt that he was becoming psychologically interesting, after all. Suddenly, he threw up his arms, as men do when they are mortally wounded on the battlefield, and I expected to see him fall at full length. Instead of this, he made a step forward. I looked in the same direction and saw a woman, who must have concealed herself there while I was waiting before the house, come from out of the gloom, and as she slowly approached and laid her head upon his shoulder, the outstretched arms clasped themselves closely around her, so that her face was hidden upon his neck. So this was the whole matter, and I had been sent off on a wild goose chase to spy out a common love affair. His opera and his seclusion for the sake of work, his tyrannical refusal to see Dettai unless he sent for him, all this was but a mask to a vulgar intrigue, which, for reasons best known to himself, could not be indulged in the city. I was thoroughly angry. If Marcello passed his time mooning about in that damp hole all night, no wonder that he looked so wretchedly ill and seemed half mad. I knew very well that Marcello was no saint. Why should he be? But I had not taken him for a fool. He had had plenty of romantic episodes, and as he was discreet without being uselessly mysterious, no one had ever unduly pried into them, nor should we have done so now. I said to myself that that mixture of French and Italian blood was at the bottom of it, French flimsiness and light-headedness, and Italian love of cunning. I looked back upon all the details of my mysterious expedition. I suppose at the root of my anger lay a certain dramatic disappointment at not finding him lying murdered, and I despised myself for all the trouble I had taken to this ridiculous end. Just to see him holding a woman in his arms. I could not see her face, and her figure was enveloped from head to foot in something long and dark, but I could make out that she was tall and slender, and that a pair of white hands gleamed from her drapery. As I was looking intently, for all my indignation, the couple moved on, and still clinging to one another, descended the steps. So even the solitude of the lonely laurel grove could not satisfy Marcello's insane love of secrecy. I kept still a while. Then I stole to where they had disappeared and listened. But all was silent, and I cautiously struck a match and peered down. I could see the steps for a short distance below me, and then the darkness seemed to rise and swallow them. It must be a catacomb, as I had imagined, or an old Roman bath, perhaps, which Marcello had made comfortable enough, no doubt, and as likely as not they were having a nice little cold supper there. My empty stomach told me that I could have forgiven him even then, could I have shared it. I was in truth frightfully hungry, as well as angry, and sat down on one of the stone benches to finish my sandwiches. The thought of waiting to see this lovesick pair return to Upper Earth never for a moment occurred to me. I had found out the whole thing, and a great humbug it was. Now I wanted to get back to Rome before my temper had cooled, and to tell Magnin on what a fool's errand he had sent me. If he liked to quarrel with me, all the better. All the way home I composed cutting French speeches, but they suddenly cooled and petrified like a gust of lava from a volcano when I discovered that the gate was closed. I had never thought of getting a pass, and Magnin ought to have warned me. Another grievance against the fellow. I enjoyed my resentment, and it kept me warm as I patrolled up and down. There are houses and even small eating shops outside the gate, but no light was visible, and I did not care to attract attention by pounding at the doors in the middle of the night. So I crept behind a bit of wall. I was getting used to hiding by this time, and made myself as comfortable as I could with my ulster, took another pull at my flask, and waited. At last the gate was opened, and I slipped through, trying not to look as though I had been out all night like a bandit. The guard looked at me narrowly, evidently wondering at my lack of luggage. Had I had a knapsack, I might have been taken for some innocently mad English tourist indulging in the mistaken pleasure of trudging in from Frascati or Albano. But a man in an ulster, with his hands in his pockets, sauntering in at the gate of the city at break of day as though returning from a stroll, naturally puzzled the officials, who looked at me and shrugged their shoulders. Luckily I found an early cab in the Piazza of the Lateran, for I was dead beat, and was soon at my lodgings in the Via della Croce, where my landlady let me in very speedily. Then, at last, I had the comfort of throwing off my clothes, all damp with the night dew, and turning in. My wrath had cooled to a certain point, and I did not fear to lower its temperature too greatly by yielding to an overwhelming desire for sleep. An hour or two could make no great difference to Magnin. Let him fancy me still hanging about the Vigna Marziale. Sleep I must have, no matter what he thought. I slept long, and was awakened at last by my landlady, Sora Nanna, standing over me and saying, "There is a signore who wants you." "It is I, Magnin," said a voice behind her. "I could not wait for you to come." He looked haggard with anxiety and watching. "Detai is raving still," he went on, "only worse than before. Speak, for heaven's sake, why don't you tell me something?" And he shook me by the arm, as though he thought I was still asleep. "Have you nothing to say? You must have seen something. Did you see Marcello?"
"Oh, yes, I saw him."
"Well?"
"Well, he was very comfortable, quite alive. He had a woman's arms around him."
I heard my door violently slammed to, a ferocious sacré gamin, and then steps springing down the stairs. I felt perfectly happy at having made such an impression, and turned and resumed my broken sleep with almost a kindly feeling towards Magnin, who was at that moment probably tearing up the Spanish scalinata two steps at a time and making himself horribly hot. It could not help Detai, poor fellow. He could not understand my news. When I had slept long enough, I got up, refreshed myself with a bath and something to eat, and went off to see Detai. It was not his fault that I had been made a fool of, so I felt sorry for him. I found him raving, just as I had left him the day before, only worse, as Magnin said. He persisted in continually crying, "Marcello, take care. No one can save you," in hoarse, weak tones, but with the regularity of a knell, keeping up a peculiar movement with his feet, as though he were weary with a long road, but must press forward to his goal. Then he would stop and break into childish sobs. "My feet are so sore," he murmured piteously, "and I am so tired. but they will come. They are following me, but I am strong. Then a violent struggle with his invisible pursuers, in which he would break off into that singing of his, alternating with the warning cry. The singing voice was quite another from the speaking one. He went on and on, repeating the singular air which he had himself called a funeral march, and which had become intensely disagreeable to me. If it was one, indeed, it surely was intended for no Christian burial. As he sang, the tears kept trickling down his cheeks, and Magnin sat wiping them away as tenderly as a woman. Between his song he would clasp his hands, feebly enough, for he was very weak when the delirium did not make him violent, and cry in heart-rending tones, "Marcello, I shall never see you again. Why did you leave us?" At last, when he stopped for a moment, Magnin left his side, beckoning the sister to take it, and drew me into the other room, closing the door behind him. "Now tell me exactly how you saw Marcello," said he. So I related my whole absurd experience, forgetting, however, my personal irritation, for he looked too wretched and worn for anybody to be angry with him. He made me repeat several times my description of Marcello's face and manner as he had come out of the house. That seemed to make more impression upon him than the love business. "Sick people have strange intuitions," he said gravely, "and I persist in thinking that Marcello is very ill and in danger. Tenez." And here he broke off, went to the door, and called, "Ma soeur," under his breath. She understood, and after having drawn the bedclothes straight and once more dried the trickling tears, she came noiselessly to where we stood, the wet handkerchief still in her hand. She was a singularly tall and strong-looking woman, with piercing black eyes and a self-controlled manner. Strange to say, she bore the adopted name of Claudius, instead of a more feminine one. "Ma soeur," said Magnin, "at what o'clock was it that he sprang out of bed and we had to hold him for so long?" "Half past 11 and a few minutes," she answered promptly. Then he turned to me. "At what time did Marcello come out into the garden?" "Well, it might have been 11:30, I answered, unwillingly. "I should say that 3/4 of an hour might possibly have passed since I rang my repeater. Mind you, I won't swear to it. I hate to have people try to prove mysterious coincidences, and this was just what they were attempting. "Are you sure of the hour, ma soeur?" I asked, a little tartly. She looked at me calmly with her great black eyes and said, "I heard the Trinità di Monte strike the half hour just before it happened." "Be so good as to tell Monsieur Sutton exactly what took place," said Magnin. "One moment, monsieur," and she went swiftly and softly to Détail, raised him on her strong arm, and held a glass to his lips, from which he drank mechanically. Then she came and stood where she could watch him through the open door. "He hears nothing," she said, as she hung the handkerchief to dry over a chair, and then she went on, "It was 11:30, and my patient had been very uneasy, that is to say, more so even than before. It might have been 4 or 5 minutes after the clock had finished striking that it became suddenly quite still, and then began to tremble all over so that the bed shook with him." She spoke admirable English, as many of the sisters do, so I need not translate, but will give her own words. "He went on trembling until I thought he was going to have a fit, and told Monsieur Magnin to be ready to go for the doctor, when just then the trembling stopped. He became perfectly stiff, his hair stood up upon his head, and his eyes seemed coming out of their sockets, though he could see nothing, for I passed the candle before them. All at once, he sprang out of his bed and rushed to the door. I did not know he was so strong. Before he got there, I had him in my arms, for he has become very light, and I carried him back to bed again, though he was struggling, like a child. Monsieur Magnin came in from the next room just as he was trying to get up again, and we held him down until it was past. But he screamed Monsieur Sylvestre's name for a long time after that. Afterwards he was very cold and exhausted, of course, and I gave him some beef tea, though it was not the hour for it.
I think you had better tell the sister all about it, said Magnin, turning to me. It is best that the nurse should know everything. Very well, said I, though I do not think it's much in her line. She answered me herself. Everything which concerns our patients is our business. Nothing shocks me. Thereupon she sat down and thrust her hands into her long sleeves, prepared to listen. I repeated the whole affair as I had done to Magnin. She never took her brilliant eyes from off my face and listened as coolly as though she had been a doctor hearing an account of a difficult case, though to me it seemed almost sacrilege to be describing the behaviour of a love-stricken youth to a sister of charity. "What do you say to that, masseur?" asked Magnin when I had done. "I say nothing, monsieur. It is sufficient that I know it." And she withdrew her hands from her sleeves, took up the handkerchief, which was dry by this time, and returned quietly to her place at the bedside. "I wonder if I have shocked her, after all," I said to Magnin. "Oh, no," he said. "They see many things, and a sir is as abstract as a confessor. They do not allow themselves any personal feelings. I have seen Sir Claudius listening perfectly unmoved to the most abominable ravings, only crossing herself beneath her cape at the most hideous blasphemies. It was late summer when poor Justin Revol died. You were not here." Magnin put his hand to his forehead. "You are looking ill yourself," I said. "Go and try to sleep, and I will stay." "Very well," he answered. "But I cannot rest unless you promise to remember everything he says, that I may hear it when I wake." And he threw himself down on the hard sofa like a sack, and was asleep in a moment. And I, who had felt so angry with him but a few hours ago, put a cushion under his head and made him comfortable. I sat down in the next room and listened to Detaille's monotonous ravings while Sir Claudius read in her book of prayers. It was getting dusk, and several of the academicians stole in and stood over the sick man and shook their heads. They looked around for Magnin, but I pointed to the other room with my finger on my lips, and they nodded and went away on tiptoe. It required no effort of memory to repeat Detaille's words to Magnin when he woke, for they were always the same. We had another sister that night, and as Sir Claudius was not to return till the next day at midday, I offered to share the watch with Magnin, who was getting very nervous and exhausted, and who seemed to think that some such attack might be expected as had occurred the night before. The new sister was a gentle, delicate-looking little woman, with tears in her soft brown eyes as she bent over the sick man and crossed herself from time to time, grasping the crucifix which hung from the beads at her waist. Nevertheless, she was calm and useful, and as punctual as Sir Claudius herself in giving the medicines. The doctor had come in the evening and prescribed a change in these. He would not say what he thought of his patient, but only declared that it was necessary to wait for a crisis. Magnin sent for some supper, and we sat over it together in the silence, neither of us hungry. He kept looking at his watch. "If the same thing happens tonight, he will die," said he, and laid his head on his arms. "He will die in a most foolish cause, then," I said angrily, for I thought he was going to cry, as those Frenchmen have a way of doing, and I wanted to irritate him by way of a tonic. So I went on. "It would be dying for a vaurien who is making an ass of himself in a ridiculous business which will be over in a week. Sylvestre may get as much fever as he likes. Only don't ask me to come and nurse him." "It is not the fever," said he slowly. "It is a horrible, nameless dread that I have. I suppose it is listening to Detaille that makes me nervous. Hark," he added, "it strikes 11. We must watch." If you really expect another attack, you had better warn the sister, I said. So he told her in a few words what might happen. Very well, monsieur, she answered, and sat down quietly near the bed, Magnin at the pillow and I near him. No sound was to be heard but Detaille's ceaseless lament. And now, before I tell you more, I must stop to entreat you to believe me. It will be almost impossible for you to do so, I know, for I have laughed myself at such tales, and no assurances would have made me credit them. But I, Robert Sutton, swear that this thing happened. More I cannot do. It is the truth. We had been watching Detaille intently. He was lying with closed eyes and had been very restless. Suddenly he became quite still and then began to tremble, exactly as Sir Claudius had described. It was a curious, uniform trembling, apparently in every fibre, and his iron bedstead shook as though strong hands were at its head and foot. Then came the absolute rigidity she had also described, and I do not exaggerate when I say that not only did his short-cropped hair seem to stand erect, but that it literally did so. A lamp cast the shadow of his profile against the wall to the left of his bed, and as I looked at the immovable outline which seemed painted on the wall, I saw the hair slowly rise until the line where it joined the forehead was quite a different one, abrupt instead of a smooth sweep. His eyes opened wide and were frightfully fixed, then as frightfully strained, but they certainly did not see us. We waited breathlessly for what might follow. The little sister was standing close to him, her lips pressed together and a little pale, but very calm. "Do not be frightened, ma sœur," whispered Magnin, and she answered in a businesslike tone, "No, monsieur," and drew still nearer to her patient and took his hands, which were stiff as those of a corpse, between her own to warm them. I laid mine upon his heart. It was beating so imperceptibly that I almost thought it had stopped, and as I leaned my face to his lips, I could feel no breath issue from them. It seemed as though the rigor would last forever. Suddenly, without any transition, he hurled himself with enormous force and literally at one bound almost into the middle of the room, scattering us aside like leaves in the wind. I was upon him in a moment, grappling with him with all my strength to prevent him from reaching the door. Magnin had been thrown backwards against the table, and I heard the medicine bottles crash with his fall. He had flung back his hand to save himself and rushed to help me with blood dripping from a cut in his wrist. The little sister sprang to us. Detaille had thrown her violently back upon her knees, and now, with a nurse's instinct, she tried to throw a shawl over his bare breast. We four must have made a strange group. Four. We were five. Marcello Silvestre stood before us, just within the door. We all saw him, for he was there. His bloodless face was turned towards us, unmoved. His hands hung by his sides, as white as his face. Only his eyes had life in them. They were fixed on Detaille. "Thank God you have come at last," I cried. "Don't stand there like a fool. Help us, can't you?" But he never moved. I was furiously angry, and, leaving my hold, sprang upon him to drag him forwards. My outstretched hands struck hard against the door, and I felt a thing like a spider's web envelop me. It seemed to draw itself over my mouth and eyes, and to blind and choke me, and then to flutter and tear and float from me. Marcello was gone. Detaille had slipped from Magnin's hold and lay in a heap upon the floor as though his limbs were broken. The sister was trembling violently as she knelt over him and tried to raise his head. We gazed at one another, stooped, and lifted him in our arms and carried him back to his bed, while Sir Marie quietly collected the broken files. "You saw it, ma sœur," I heard Magnin whisper hoarsely. "Yes, monsieur," she only answered in a trembling voice, holding on to her crucifix. Then she said in a professional tone, "Will Monsieur let me bind up his wrist?" And though her fingers trembled and his hand was shaking, the bandage was an irreproachable one. Magnin went into the next room, and I heard him throw himself heavily into a chair. De Taille seemed to be sleeping. His breath came regularly. His eyes were closed with a look of peace about the lids, his hands lying in a natural way upon the quilt. He had not moved since we laid him there. I went softly to where Magnin was sitting in the dark. He did not move, but only said, "Marcello is dead." "He's either dead or dying," I answered, "and we must go to him." "Yes," Magnin whispered, "we must go to him, but we shall not reach him." "We will go as soon as it is light," I said, and then we were still again. When the morning came, at last, he went and found a comrade to take his place, and only said to Sir Marie, "It is not necessary to speak of this night," and at her quiet, "You are right, monsieur." We felt we could trust her. De Taille was still sleeping. Was this the crisis the doctor had expected? Perhaps, but surely not in such fearful form. I insisted upon my companion having some breakfast before we started, and I breakfasted myself, but I cannot say I tasted what passed between my lips. We engaged a closed carriage, for we did not know what we might bring home with us, though neither of us spoke out his thoughts. It was early morning still when we reached the Vigna Marziale, and we had not exchanged a word all the way. I rang at the bell, while the coachman looked on curiously. It was answered promptly by the guardiano, of whom De Taille has already told you. "Where is the signore?" I asked through the gate. "Chi lo sa?" he answered. "He is here, of course. He has not left the Vigna. Shall I call him?" "Call him?" I knew that no mortal voice could reach Marcello now, but I tried to fancy he was still alive. "No," I said. "Let us in. We want to surprise him. He will be pleased." The man hesitated, but he finally opened the gate, and we entered, leaving the carriage to wait outside. We went straight to the house. The door at the back was wide open. There had been a gale in the night, and it had torn some leaves and bits of twigs from the trees and blown them into the entrance hall. They lay scattered across the threshold and were evidence that the door had remained open ever since they had fallen. The guardiano left us, probably to escape Marcello's anger at having let us in, and we went up the stairs unhindered, Magnin foremost, for he knew the house better than I, from De Taille's description. He had told him about the corner room with the balcony, and we pretended that Marcello might be there, absorbed betimes in his work. But we did not call him. He was not there. His papers were strewn over the table as though he had been writing, but the inkstand was dry and full of dust. He could not have used it for days. We went silently into the other chambers. Perhaps he was still asleep. But no. We found his bed untouched, so he could not have lain in it that night. The rooms were all unlocked but one, and this closed door made our hearts beat. Marcello could scarcely be there, however, for there was no key in the lock. I saw the daylight shining through the keyhole. We called his name, but there came no answer. We knocked loudly, still no sign from within, so I put my shoulder to the door, which was old and cracked in several places, and succeeded in bursting it open. Nothing was there but a sculptor's modelling stand, with something upon it covered with a white cloth, and the modelling tools on the floor. At the sight of the cloth, still damp, we drew a deep breath. It could have hung there for many hours, certainly not for 24. We did not raise it. "He would be vexed," said Magnin, and I nodded, for it is accounted almost a crime in the artist's world to unveil a sculptor's work behind his back. We expressed no surprise at the fact of his modelling. A ban seemed to lie upon our tongues. The cloth hung tightly to the object beneath it and showed us the outline of a woman's head and rounded bust, and so veiled we left her. There was a little winding stair leading out of the passage, and we climbed it to find ourselves in a sort of belvedere commanding a superb view. It was a small open terrace on the roof of the house, and we saw at a glance that no one was there. We had now been all over the casino, which was small and simply built, being evidently intended only for short summer use. As we stood leaning over the balustrade, we could look down into the garden. No one was there but the Guadiano, lying amongst his cabbages with his arms behind his head, half asleep. The laurel grove had been in my mind from the beginning, only it had seemed more natural to go to the house first. Now we descended the stairs silently and directed our steps thither. As we approached it, the Guadiano came towards us lazily. "Have you seen the Signore?" he asked, and his stupidly placid face showed me that he, at least, had no hand in his disappearance. "No, not yet," I answered, "but we shall come across him somewhere, no doubt. Perhaps he has gone to take a walk, and we will wait for him." "What is this?" I went on, trying to seem careless. We were standing now by the little arch of which you know. "This," he said. "I have never been down there, but they say it is something old. Do the signori want to see it? I will fetch a lantern." I nodded, and he went off to his cabin. I had a couple of candles in my pocket, for I had intended to explore the place should we not find Marcello. It was there that he had disappeared that night, and my thoughts had been busy with it. But I kept my candles concealed, reflecting that they would give our search an air of premeditation which would excite curiosity. "When did you see the Signore last?" I asked, when he had returned with the lantern. "I brought him his supper yesterday evening." "At what o'clock?" "It was the Ave Maria, Signore," he replied. "He always sups then." It would be useless to put any further questions. He was evidently utterly unobserving and would lie to please us. "Let me go first," said Magnin, taking the lantern. We set our feet upon the steps. A cold air seemed to fill our lungs and yet to choke us, and a thick darkness lay beneath. The steps, as I could see by the light of my candle, were modern, as well as the vaulting above them. A tablet was let into the wall, and in spite of my excitement, I paused to read it, perhaps because I was glad to delay whatever awaited us below. It ran thus: "Questo antico sepolcro romano scoprì il conte Marziale nel anno 1853. E piamente conservo." In plain English, Count Marziale discovered this ancient Roman sepulchre in the year 1853 and piously preserved it. I read it more quickly than it has taken time to write here, and hurried after Magnin, whose footsteps sounded faintly below me. As I hastened, a draught of cold air extinguished my candle, and I was trying to make my way down by feeling along the wall, which was horribly dark and clammy, when my heart stood still at a cry from far beneath me, a cry of horror. "Where are you?" I shouted, but Magnin was calling my name and could not hear me. "I am here. I am in the dark." I was making haste as fast as I could, but there were several turnings. "I have found him," came up from below. "Alive?" I shouted. No answer. One last short flight brought me face to face with the gleam of the lantern. It came from a low doorway, and within stood Magnin, peering into the darkness. I knew by his face, as he held the light high above him, that our fears were realized. Yes, Marcello was there. He was lying stretched upon the floor, staring at the ceiling, dead and already stiff, as I could see at a glance. We stood over him, saying not a word. Then I knelt down and felt him, for mere form's sake, and said as though I had not known it before, "He has been dead for some hours."
since yesterday evening," said Manya in a horror-stricken voice, yet with a certain satisfaction in it, as though to say, "You see, I was right." Marcello was lying with his head slightly thrown back, no contortions in his handsome features, rather the look of a person who has quietly died of exhaustion, who has slipped unconsciously from life to death. His collar was thrown open, and a part of his breast, of a ghastly white, was visible. Just over the heart was a small spot. "Give me the lantern," I whispered as I stooped over it. It was a very little spot, of a faint purplish brown, and must have changed colour within the night. I examined it intently, and should say that the blood had been sucked to the surface, and then a small prick or incision made. The slight subcutaneous effusion led me to this conclusion. One tiny drop of coagulated blood closed the almost imperceptible wound. I probed it with the end of one of Magnan's matches. It was scarcely more than skin deep, so it could not be the stab of a stiletto, however slender, or the track of a bullet. Still, it was strange, and with one impulse we turned to see if no one were concealed there, or if there were no second exit. It would be madness to suppose that the murderer, if there was one, would remain by his victim. Had Marcello been making love to a pretty contadina, and was this some jealous lover's vengeance? But it was not a stab. Had one drop of poison in the little wound done this deadly work? We peered about the place, and I saw that Magnan's eyes were blinded by tears, and his face as pale as that upturned one on the floor, whose lids I had vainly tried to close. The chamber was low and beautifully ornamented with stucco bas-reliefs, in the manner of the well-known one not far from there upon the same road. Winged genii, griffins and arabesques, modelled with marvellous lightness, covered the walls and ceiling. There was no other door than the one we had entered by. In the centre stood a marble sarcophagus with the usual subjects sculptured upon it, on the one side Hercules conducting a veiled figure, on the other a dance of nymphs and fauns. A space in the middle contained the following inscription, deeply cut in the stone and still partially filled with red pigment: D.M. Vespertiliae tis Aemotopodios, Q. Flavius, Vix ipse sospes mon possuit. "What is this?" whispered Manier. It was only a pickaxe and a long crowbar, such as the country people use in hewing out their blocks of tufa, and his foot had struck against them. Who could have brought them here? They must belong to the Guardiano above, but he said that he had never come here, and I believed him, knowing the Italian horror of darkness and lonely places. But what had Marcello wanted with them? It did not occur to us that archaeological curiosity could have led him to attempt to open the sarcophagus, the lid of which had evidently never been raised, thus justifying the expression "piously preserved." As I rose from examining the tools, my eyes fell upon the line of mortar where the cover joined to the stone below, and I noticed that some of it had been removed, perhaps with the pickaxe which lay at my feet. I tried it with my nails and found that it was very crumbly. Without a word, I took the tool in my hand, Magna instinctively following my movements with the lantern. What impelled us, I do not know. I had myself no thought, only an irresistible desire to see what was within. I saw that much of the mortar had been broken away and lay in small fragments upon the ground, which I had not noticed before. It did not take long to complete the work. I snatched the lantern from Magnan's hand and set it upon the ground, where it shone full upon Marcello's dead face, and by its light I found a little break between the two masses of stone, and managed to insert the end of my crowbar, driving it in with a blow of the pickaxe. The stone chipped and then cracked a little. Magnan was shivering. "What are you going to do?" he said, looking around at where Marcello lay. "Help me,
I cried, and we two bore with all our might upon the crowbar. I am a strong man, and I felt a sort of blind fury as the stone refused to yield. What if the bar should snap? With another blow I drove it in still further, then, using it as a lever, we weighed upon it with our outstretched arms until every muscle was at its highest tension. The stone moved a little, and almost fainting, we stopped to rest. From the ceiling hung the rusty remnant of an iron chain, which must once have held a lamp. To this, by scrambling upon the sarcophagus, I contrived to make fast the lantern. "Now," said I, and we heaved again at the lid. It rose, and we alternately heaved and pushed until it lost its balance and fell with a thundering crash upon the other side. Such a crash that the walls seemed to shake, and I was for a moment utterly deafened, while little pieces of stucco rained upon us from the ceiling. When we had paused to recover from the shock, we leaned over the sarcophagus and looked in. The light shone full upon it, and we saw, how is it possible to tell? We saw lying there, amidst folds of mouldering rags, the body of a woman, perfect as in life, with faintly rosy face, soft crimson lips, and a breast of living pearl, which seemed to heave as though stirred by some delicious dream. The rotten stuff swathed about her was in ghastly contrast to this lovely form, fresh as the morning. Her hands lay stretched at her side. The pink palms were turned a little outwards. Her eyes were closed as peacefully as those of a sleeping child, and her long hair, which shone red-gold in the dim light from above, was wound around her head in numberless finely plaited tresses, beneath which little locks escaped in rings upon her brow. I could have sworn that the blue veins on that divinely perfect bosom held living blood. We were absolutely paralyzed, and Magnin leaned, gasping, over the edge as pale as death, paler by far than this living, almost smiling face to which his eyes were glued. I do not doubt that I was as pale as he at this inexplicable vision. As I looked, the red lips seemed to grow redder. They were redder. The little pearly teeth showed between them. I had not seen them before, and now a clear ruby drop trickled down to her rounded chin, and from there slipped sideways and fell upon her neck. Horror-struck, I gazed upon the living corpse till my eyes could not bear the sight any longer. As I looked away, my glance fell once more upon the inscription, but now I could see and read it all. To Vespertilia, that was in Latin, and even the Latin name of the woman suggested a thing of evil flitting in the dusk. But the full horror of the nature of that thing had been veiled to Roman eyes under the Greek tis Amatopodios, the blood-drinker, the vampire woman. And Flavius, her lover, vix ipse sospes, himself hardly saved from that deadly embrace, had buried her here and set a seal upon her sepulchre, trusting to the weight of stone and the strength of clinging mortar to imprison for ever the beautiful monster he had loved. "Infamous murderess!" I cried. "You have killed Marcello!" And a sudden, vengeful calm came over me. "Give me the pickaxe," I said to Magnin. I can hear myself saying it still. He picked it up and handed it to me as in a dream. He seemed little better than an idiot, and the beads of sweat were shining on his forehead. I took my knife, and from the long wooden handle of the pickaxe I cut a fine, sharp stake. Then I clambered, scarcely feeling any repugnance, over the side of the sarcophagus, my feet amongst the folds of Vespertilia's decaying winding sheet, which crushed like ashes beneath my boot. I looked for one moment at that white breast, but only to choose the loveliest spot, where the network of azure veins shimmered like veiled turquoises, and then, with one blow, I drove the pointed stake deep down through the breathing snow and stamped it in with my heel.
An awful shriek, so ringing and horrible that I thought my ears must have burst. But even then I felt neither fear nor horror. There are times when these cannot touch us. I stopped and gazed once again at the face, now undergoing a fearful change, fearful and final. "Foul vampire," I said quietly in my concentrated rage, "you will do no more harm now." And then, without looking back upon her cursed face, I clambered out of the horrible tomb. We raised Marcello and slowly carried him up the steep stairs, a difficult task, for the way was narrow and he was so stiff. I noticed that the steps were ancient after the end of the second flight. Above, the modern passage was somewhat broader. When we reached the top, the Guardiano was lying upon one of the stone benches. He did not mean us to cheat him out of his fee. I gave him a couple of francs. "You see that we have found the Signore," I tried to say in a natural voice. "He is very weak, and we will carry him to the carriage." I had thrown my handkerchief over Marcello's face, but the man knew as well as I did that he was dead. Those stiff feet told their own story. But Italians are timid of being involved in such affairs. They have a childish dread of the police, and he only answered, "Poor signorino, he is very ill. It is better to take him to Rome." And kept cautiously clear of us as we went up to the ilex alley with our icy burden, and he did not go to the gate with us, not liking to be observed by the coachman who was dozing on his box. With difficulty we got Marcello's corpse into the carriage, the driver turning to look at us suspiciously. I explained we had found our friend very ill, and at the same time slipped a gold piece into his hand, telling him to drive to the Via del Governo Vecchio. He pocketed the money and whipped his horses into a trot while we sat supporting the stiff body, which swayed like a broken doll at every pebble in the road. When we reached the Via del Governo Vecchio at last, no one saw us carry him into the house. There was no step before the door, and we drew up so close to it that it was possible to screen our burden from sight. When we had brought him into his room and laid him upon his bed, we noticed that his eyes were closed, from the movement of the carriage, perhaps, though that was scarcely possible. The landlady behaved very much as I had expected her to do, for, as I told you, I know the Italians. She pretended, too, that the Signore was very ill, and made a pretense of offering to fetch a doctor, and when I thought it best to tell her that he was dead, declared that it must have happened that very moment, for she had seen him look at us and close his eyes again. She had always told him that he ate too little, and that he would be ill. Yes, it was weakness and that bad air out there which had killed him, and then he worked too hard. When she had successfully established this fiction, which we were glad enough to agree to, for neither did we wish for the publicity of an inquest, she ran out and fetched a gossip to come and keep her company. So died Marcello Souvestre, and so died Vespertilia, the blood drinker, at last. There is not much more to tell. Marcello lay calm and beautiful upon his bed, and the students came and stood silently looking at him, then knelt down for a moment to say a prayer, crossed themselves, and left him forever. We hastened to the Villa Medici, where Dettai was sleeping, and Sister Claudius watching him with a satisfied look on her strong face. She rose noiselessly at our entrance and came to us at the threshold. "He will recover," said she softly. She was right. When he awoke and opened his eyes, he knew us directly, and Magnan breathed a devout, "Thank God." "Have I been ill, Magnan?" he asked very feebly. "You have had a little fever," answered Magnan promptly. "But it is over now. Here is Monsieur Sutton come to see you." "Has Marcello been here?" was the next question. Magnan looked at him very steadily. "No," he only said,
letting his face tell the rest.
Is he dead, then?
Magnin only bowed his head.
Poor friend.
The Thai murmured to himself, then closed his heavy eyes and slept again. A few days after Marcello's funeral, we went to the fatal Vigna Marziale to bring back the objects which had belonged to him. As I laid the manuscript score of the opera carefully together, my eye fell upon a passage which struck me as the identical one which de Thai had so constantly sung in his delirium, and which I noted down. Strange to say, when I reminded him of it later, it was perfectly new to him, and he declared that Marcello had not let him examine his manuscript. As for the veiled bust in the other room, we left it undisturbed and to crumble away unseen.
The Fate of Madame Cabanel by Eliza Lynn Linton. Eliza Lynn Linton, 1822-1898, was born in Keswick, England, the daughter of a clergyman. An independent-minded woman, she moved on her own to London in 1845 as the protégé of the poet William Savage Lander. She wrote several novels without notable success and turned to journalism, joining the staff of the Morning Chronicle and Charles Dickens's All the Year Round. In 1858, she married W. J. Linton, a well-known poet and wood engraver, but separated after a decade, evidently on good terms, as she raised one of his daughters by a previous marriage. Her former husband moved to America, and she returned to writing novels, this time achieving a wide readership with such titles as The True History of Joshua Davidson, 1872, and Christopher Kirkland, 1885, which is largely autobiographical, though in the voice of a man. She has been a source of confusion for scholars attempting to understand her politics, because, although a strong woman with a powerful individual personality and lifestyle, she was violently opposed to the New Woman movement of feminism. Her very leisurely and measured style has not meshed well with modern readers, and she is rarely read today. The Fate of Madame Cabanel was first published in book form in With a Silken Thread and Other Stories, London, Chatto and Windus, 1880.
The Fate of Madame Cabanel by Eliza Lynn Linton. Read by Cassandra Campbell. Progress had not invaded, science had not enlightened, the little hamlet of Puvreux in Brittany. They were a simple, ignorant, superstitious set who lived there, and the luxuries of civilization were known to them as little as its learning. They toiled hard all the week on the ungrateful soil that yielded them but a bare subsistence in return. They went regularly to Mass in the little rock-set chapel on Sundays and Saints' Days, believed implicitly all that Monsieur le Curé said to them, and many things which he did not say. And they took all the unknown, not as magnificent, but as diabolical. The sole link between them and the outside world of mind and progress was Monsieur Jules Cabanel, the proprietor par excellence of the place, maire, juge de paix, and all the public functionaries rolled into one. And he sometimes went to Paris, whence he returned with a cargo of novelties that excited envy, admiration, or fear, according to the degree of intelligence in those who beheld them. Monsieur Jules Cabanel was not the most charming man of his class in appearance, but he was generally held to be a good fellow at bottom. A short, thick-set, low-browed man, with blue-black hair cropped close like a mat, as was his blue-black beard, inclined to obesity and fond of good living. He had need have some virtues behind the bush to compensate for his want of personal charms. He was not bad, however. He was only common and unlovely. Up to 50 years of age, he had remained the unmarried prize of the surrounding country, but hitherto he had resisted all the overtures made by maternal fowlers, and had kept his liberty and his bachelorhood intact. Perhaps his handsome housekeeper, Adele, had something to do with his persistent celibacy. They said she had, under their breath, as it were, down at La Veuve Prieur's. But no one dared to so much as hint the like to herself. She was a proud, reserved kind of woman, and had strange notions of her own dignity which no one cared to disturb. So, whatever the underhand gossip of the place might be, neither she nor her master got wind of it. Presently, and quite suddenly, Jules Cabanel, who had been for a longer time than usual in Paris, came home with a wife. Adele had only 24 hours' notice to prepare for this strange homecoming, and the task seemed heavy. But she got through it in her old way of silent determination. Arranged the rooms as she knew her master would wish them to be arranged, and even supplemented the usual nice adornments by a voluntary bunch of flowers on the salon table.
"Strange flowers for a bride," said to herself little Jeannette, the goose girl who was sometimes brought into the house to work, as she noticed heliotrope, called in France la fleur des veuves, scarlet poppies, a bunch of belladonna, another of aconite. Scarcely, as even ignorant little Jeannette said, flowers of bridal welcome or bridal significance. Nevertheless, they stood where Adele had placed them. And if Monsieur Cabanel meant anything by the passionate expression of disgust with which he ordered them out of his sight, Madame seemed to understand nothing. As she smiled with that vague, half-deprecating look of a person who is assisting at a scene of which the true bearing is not understood. Madame Cabanel was a foreigner, and an Englishwoman, young, pretty, and fair as an angel.
"La beauté du diable," said the
Pauvrotines, with something between a sneer and a shudder. For the words meant with them more than they mean in ordinary use. Swarthy, ill-nourished, low of stature, and meager in frame as they were themselves, they could not understand the plump form, tall figure, and fresh complexion of the Englishwoman. Unlike their own experience, it was therefore more likely to be evil than good. The feeling which had sprung up against her at first sight deepened when it was observed that although she went to Mass with praiseworthy punctuality, she did not know her missal, and signed herself à travers.
La beauté du diable en faith.
Veuf,
said Martin Briolic, the old gravedigger of the little cemetery.
With those red lips of hers, her rose cheeks and her plump shoulders, she looks like a vampire, and as if she lived on blood.
He said this one evening down at La Veuve Prieur's, and he said it with an air of conviction that had its weight. For Martin Briolic was reputed the wisest man of the district, not even excepting Monsieur le Curé, who was wise in his own way, which was not Martin's, nor Monsieur Cabanel, who was wise in his, which was neither Martin's nor the Curé's. He knew all about the weather and the stars, the wild herbs that grew on the plains, and the wild shy beasts that eat them. And he had the power of divination, and could find where the hidden springs of water lay far down in the earth when he held the baguette in his hand. He knew, too, where treasures could be had on Christmas Eve if only you were quick and brave enough to enter the cleft in the rock at the right moment and come out again before too late. And he had seen with his own eyes the white ladies dancing in the moonlight, and the little imps, the enfants, playing their prankish gambols by the pit at the edge of the wood. And he had a shrewd suspicion as to who, among those black-hearted men of La Crache-en-Bois, the rival hamlet, was a loup-garou. If ever there was one on the face of the earth, and no one had doubted that. He had other powers of a yet more mystic kind, so that Martin Briolic's bad word went for something. if, with the illogical injustice of ill nature, his good went for nothing. Fanny Campbell, or, as she was now, Madame Cabanel, would have excited no special attention in England, or indeed anywhere but at such a dead, alive, ignorant, and consequently gossiping place as Puvreux. She had no romantic secret as her background, and what history she had was commonplace enough, if sorrowful, too, in its own way. She was simply an orphan and a governess, very young and very poor, whose employers had quarreled with her and left her stranded in Paris, alone and almost moneyless, and who had married Monsieur Jules Cabanel as the best thing she could do for herself. Loving no one else, she was not difficult to be won by the first man who showed her kindness in her hour of trouble and destitution, and she accepted her middle-aged suitor, who was fitter to be her father than her husband, with a clear conscience and a determination to do her duty cheerfully and faithfully, all without considering herself as a martyr or an interesting victim sacrificed to the cruelty of circumstances. She did not know, however, of the handsome housekeeper Adèle, nor of the housekeeper's little nephew, to whom her master was so kind that he allowed him to live at the Maison Cabanel, and had him well taught by the curé. Perhaps if she had, she would have thought twice before she put herself under the same roof with a woman who for a bridal bouquet offered her poppies, heliotrope, and poison flowers. If one had to name the predominant characteristic of Madame Cabanel, it would be easiness of temper. You saw it in the round, soft, indolent lines of her face and figure, in her mild blue eyes and placid, unvarying smile, which irritated the more petulant French temperament and especially disgusted Adèle. It seemed impossible to make Madame angry, or even make her understand when she was insulted, the housekeeper used to say with profound disdain. And to do the woman justice, she did not spare her endeavors to enlighten her. But Madame accepted all Adèle's haughty reticence and defiant continuance of mistresshood with unwearied sweetness. Indeed, she expressed herself gratified that so much trouble was taken off her hands, and that Adèle so kindly took her duties on herself. The consequences of this placid, lazy life, where all her faculties were in a manner asleep, and where she was enjoying the reaction from her late years of privation and anxiety, was, as might be expected, an increase in physical beauty that made her freshness and good condition still more remarkable. Her lips were redder, her cheeks rosier, her shoulders plumper than ever. But as she waxed, the health of the little hamlet waned. And not the oldest inhabitant remembered so sickly a season, or so many deaths. The master, too, suffered slightly. The little Adolphe, desperately. This failure of general health in undrained hamlets is not uncommon in France or in England. Neither is the steady and pitiable decline of French children. But Adèle treated it as something out of all the lines of normal experience, and breaking through her habits of reticence, spoke to everyone quite fiercely of the strange sickliness that had fallen on Puvreux and the Maison Cabanel, and how she believed it was something more than common. While as to her little nephew, she could give neither a name nor find a remedy for the mysterious disease that had attacked him. There were strange things among them, she used to say, and Puvreux had never done well since the old times were changed. Jeannette used to notice how she would sit gazing at the English lady, with such a deadly look on her handsome face when she turned from the foreigner's fresh complexion and grand physique to the pale face of the stunted, meager, fading child. It was a look, she said afterwards, that used to make her flesh get like ice and creep like worms. One night Adèle, as if she could bear it no longer, dash down to where old Martin Briolique lived to ask him to tell her how it had all come about and the remedy.
"Hold, Mam Adèle," said Martin,
as he shuffled his greasy tarot cards and laid them out in triplets on the table.
"There is more in this than one sees. One sees only a poor little child become suddenly sick. That may be, is it not so? And no harm done by man. God sends sickness to us all and makes my trade profitable to me. But the little Adolphe has not been touched by the good God. I see the will of a wicked woman in this. Hein!"
Here, he shuffled the cards and laid them out with a kind of eager distraction of manner, his withered hands trembling and his mouth uttering words that Adèle could not catch.
"Saint Joseph and all the saints protect us," he cried. "The foreigner, the English woman, she whom they call Madame Cabanel, no rightful Madame she. Ah, misery! Speak, Father Martin. What do you mean?"
cried Adèle, grasping his arm. Her black eyes were wild, her arched nostrils dilated, her lips, thin, sinuous, flexible, were pressed tight over her small, square teeth.
"Tell me in plain words what you would say."
"Broucolaque,"
said Martin in a low voice.
"It is what I believed," cried Adèle. "It is what I knew. Oh, my Adolphe! Woe on the day when the master brought that fair-skinned devil home! Those red lips don't come by nothing, Mam Adèle," cried Martin, nodding his head. "Look at them. They glisten with blood. I said so from the beginning, and the cards, they said so too. I drew blood and a bad fair woman on the evening when the master brought her home. And I said to myself, 'Ha ha, Martin, you are on the track, my boy, on the track, Martin.' And Mam Adèle, I have never left it."
Broucolaque.
That is what the cards say, Mam Adèle. Vampire. Watch and see, watch and see, and you'll find that the cards have spoken true."
"And when we have found Martin," said Adèle in a hoarse whisper.
The old man shuffled his cards again.
"When we have found Mam Adèle," he said slowly. "You know the old pit out there by the forest? The old pit where the lutins run in and out, and where the white ladies wring the necks of those who come upon them in the moonlight. Perhaps the white ladies will do as much for the English wife of Monsieur Cabanel. Who knows?"
"They may," said Adèle gloomily.
"Courage, brave woman," said Martin. "They will."
The only really pretty place about Puvreux was the cemetery. To be sure, there was the dark, gloomy forest, which was grand in its own mysterious way, and there was the broad, wide plain where you might wander for a long summer's day and not come to the end of it. But these were scarcely places where a young woman would care to go by herself. And for the rest, the miserable little patches of cultivated ground, which the peasants had snatched from the surrounding waste and where they had raised poor crops, were not very lovely. So Madame Cabanel, who for all the soft indolence that had invaded her, had the Englishwoman's inborn love for walking and fresh air, haunted the pretty little graveyard a good deal. She had no sentiment connected with it. Of all the dead who laid there in their narrow coffins, she knew none and cared for none. But she liked to see the pretty little flower beds and the wreaths of immortelles and the like. The distance, too, from her own home was just enough for her, and the view over the plain to the dark belt of forest and mountains beyond was fine. The Puvrotines did not understand this. It was inexplicable to them that anyone, not out of her mind, should go continually to the cemetery, not on the Day of the Dead and not to adorn the grave of one she loved, only to sit there and wander among the tombs, looking out onto the plain and the mountains beyond when she was tired.
It was just like...
The speaker, one Le Souf, had got so far as this when he stopped for a word. He said this down at La Veuve Prieur's, where the hamlet collected nightly to discuss the day's small doings, and where the main theme, ever since she had come among them 3 months ago now, had been Madame Cabanel.